Thank you very much. Thank you, Michele, for this nice occasion, this invitation. I'd like to thank the whole perimeter for this invitation. I will talk about quantum space time, as you see from the title, and I will first maybe just give a modern plan and abstract of the talk, since this way I can say things that I will not be able to say because I'll be late then. So first I will talk about foundation of quantum space-time of first principles. That means why quantum mechanics, together with the classical theory of generativity, applies quantum space-time via the existence of space-time uncertainty relations, which are forced upon us, which are best implemented by space-time commutation relations. And if time remains, maybe at the very end, I will comment on a development which to me is the most suggestive scenario. If you go all the way along with this argument, you are led to expect that the commutator between coordinates is not some constant object, but something which has to depend upon the metric tensor. This is based on the same principle. And this means to a very complicated, leads to a very complicated scenario where the commutational relations are part of the equation of motion themselves. But this would mean something, that as Einstein told us, that geometry is actually dynamics. Quantum gravity, in the end, will tell us that also algebra is dynamics, because the very algebraic relations are related to dynamics. And this is more speculative. It is related to the existence of a positive cosmology constant, to the fact that you can have explained the equilibrium of cosmic microwave background without inflation and possibly dark matter. But most of the time we will talk of a simplified model, we call the basic model of quantum space time, where the commutator does not depend upon the metric, and it is singled out by some simple quantum condition, which is essentially only one. The commutator is central, the contraction with itself is zero, but this other invariant, which I take is square because otherwise it would be a pseudo-scalar, not a scalar, has to be one. Of course, in absolute units, this means that here you have an appropriate power of Planck length in actually the eighth power, Planck length in generic units. Yeah. And this model does implement exactly the minimal form of the space-time uncertainty relation that you might possibly write down. And it has some consequences I will talk about. First of all, it is fully Poincaré covariant model. It implies, also it's completely relativistic, that the Euclidean distance between two events has to be with a positive minimum, always in absolute unit, of course. And it has lots of other implications, like extra dimensions and effective discretization of space-time, etc. This all was done in 94-95 in papers with Frelinghagen and Roberts. While these comments, I want to throw the responsibility on anybody else, is described in some announcement in 2001-2006. So the second part of my talk will be quantum field theory in quantum space-time. And there you meet, as you probably all know, a rather surprising, unpleasant fact that also the model of quantum space-time is completely Lorentz invariant in its geometrical structure. Also, if you introduce free fields of quantum space-time, you can do it in a fully Poincaré covariant way. As soon as you try to write down interactions between fields, whatever you do, sooner or later you break Lorentz invariance. This is a fact. Maybe it depends upon the fact you are not yet smart enough to do it in the proper way. This might well be, but so far that's the situation. However, there are also some positive aspects that come out. If you take the quantum nature of space-time in proper account, and then you consider the fact that the separation between two dependent events is also quantum variables, and as such it cannot be set to zero, but it can only be made as small as possible in a compatible way with the uncertainty relation. If you take this into account, you are led to a redefinition of the weak product, the so-called quantum weak product. If you plug this in the interaction Hamiltonian, you end up with an S-matrix which is free completely of any ultraviolet divergences. Of course, other problems remain, because this process breaks Lorentz invariance in a fundamental way. If you have problems with removing the adiabatic switch off, there are problems, but the intervariate divergency disappear for all power interactions. And another pleasant factor is that S matrix results from this construction fall off, has a matrix elements which fall off very fast at Trans-Planckian energy, like polynomials times quotients. So, if there is time, this will be the second part of the talk, but this, what I just mentioned, was done in a paper with Dorothea Barnes, Gerardo Piacitelli, and Klaus Fedenhagen in 2003, so it's not so recent. And if I would like more to concentrate on more recent results, which are not yet written up, it's a work in progress with Klaus Fedenhagen, about the geometry of quantum space-time. By geometry, I mean something very elementary, the etymological sense, just measuring length, area, volume operators. And the result is that on this basic model of quantum space-time, you find something that I already mentioned, namely that the distance between two, there is a misprint here, this is a four anyway, the distance, the Euclidean distance between two dependent events is always bounded below by something of or the unit in Planck units. The area operators also are bounded below by unit in Planck units. And remark that I put here the bars because these operators are not self-adjoint operators. As far as you take the distance between the separation between two events, you have a difference between self-adjoint operators, it remains self-adjoint. Yeah? But if you take area three volume or four volume, you have products of non-commutative operators, and they're no longer self-adjoint, but it's clear why, because if you change the order to vertices, this means that you add the commutator, which is something skewed joint. Yeah? So you cannot expect that they are self-adjoint operator. However, what you do find, which is pleasant, they're all normal operators, the area operators, the three volume, and the four volume operators. They're all normal operators, namely they commute with their joint. Yeah? But the, as far as the spectrum, you have some surprise a priori, which are not a real surprise. The area is bounded below, both the space area and the time-space area are bounded below by order unit. The three-volume operator is not bounded below at all. Actually, the spectrum of this normal operator fills up the whole complex plane. While the four-volume operator, which is a pseudo-scalar, has a very nice, a curious spectrum. It's a normal operator, but with pure point spectrum, quite opposite to this one, which has continuous spectrum, has pure point spectrum. And this pure point spectrum has a real part, which is discrete, and an imaginary part, which is, of course, discrete too, but dense in the real line, because the it's integer combination of two unconventionable non-rationals. Yeah? So it fills up the whole line. So the modulus keeps away from zero or something of the unit, which is 2 minus square root of 5. Yeah? Square root of 5 enters here just because space-time has four dimensions, and 5 is 4 plus 1, as we'll see. Yeah? So it's very special to four dimensions, but I don't know whether there are relations with the golden ratio in ancient Greek architecture or whatever, yeah? And, this magic number square root of 5 appears for mysterious reasons. Okay, so we'll try to be a bit fast if possible, because I think that the first part is rather well known. You know that in ordinary Minkowski space, you have this fundamental principle, which is locality, which includes in itself, in a rather surprising way, all the core of the conceptual structure of quantum field theory. However, the strict locality principle, of course, is dependent upon the fact that you have points in ordinary space-time, and saying that you can localize the event at a point is just saying that the uncertainties can be made as small as you like, but you realize very soon that if you take into account gravitation, this is no longer the case, because localizing an event or even one single coordinate to the prism A means spending energy given by the Heisenberg principle. This energy will create some gravitational field, and if the uncertainties are too small, this gravitational field might prevent signals to leave the region where you want to localize the event and reach a distant observer, right? This means that, okay, it is well known that if you take uncertainties to be all equal to one another in space and they take a stationary rotation invariant case, then you have a Schwarzschild radius which has to be not larger than your uncertainty, but which is given by the energy itself, and this gives you a very nice motivation why the Planck length is fundamental, because this uncertainty has to be at least one. This is a very old argument, but what was not realized before the 90s, very strangely, is that if you push this argument to different values of various uncertainties, you get uncertainty relations. And actually, it's an exercise for a freshman to show that if you take, again, a stationary solution and you consider one or two uncertainties, as small as you like, no limitation, yeah, but fixed, and you let the third uncertainty, or the second and third, to become as large as you like, then the classical gravitational potential generated by such a distribution of energy will tend to zero everywhere. So you don't expect, if there is no Newtonian correction, there will be no quantum gravity correction. You expect there is no obstacle to measuring one or two coordinates with arbitrary precision, provided that the third one is very large. So, in general, there must be uncertainty relations. Now, I just tell you the result. The minimal uncertainty relations that we found pushing this argument, the early 90s, are these ones. The time uncertainty times the sup or the sum of the space uncertainty has to be one, and you must have this combination among the space uncertainty. Yeah. So, one would expect that any model of quantum space-time has to implement at least these uncertainties. But I would like to insist that this is a minimal form, which is certainly necessary to prevent that instability, gravitational instability of space-time under localization event, but it's not sufficient. Yeah. Yes?
Do you worry about how these transform under Poincaré transformation?
Yes, yes, we do. So they don't look covariant by themselves, but the model which implements exactly is fully Poincaré covariant. Now I'll show you the conditions. So, while I should make some comments very briefly, you will wonder why we use coordinate. We would like to discuss quantum Minkowski space, not quantum Einstein space-time. Yeah? That would be too ambitious. Yeah? We just want quantum Minkowski space as an ambient to discuss scattering between elementary particles in extreme energy regions where the gravitation might become important for the scattering experiment, not for the background. Yeah? And another comment is related to your question, namely, the model will implement the full classical Poincaré group. Why the classical Poincaré group? Because we want our space asymmetries to be the global motions of space-time. And the global motion should act in the same way in the small and in the large. In the large, you expect that there is the classical group, because in the large, quantum space-time has to be, again, the ordinary Minkowski space-time. Yeah. So this is a reason why we expect to have the classical Poincaré group, and we do find it. Okay. Yes?
In this analysis that led to the interview, do you make concrete models of measurements?
Yeah, well, I wanted to skip this part because it's pretty old and they will not reach the end. But if you are interested, we can postpone that to the discussions. But basically, we took as a model of the localization experiment, or the result of a localization experiment, in coherent state of a free field, and described the solution of the Einstein equation who come out taking as sources the energy momentum density generated by these coherent states. And we found and we imposed this condition that signals should be able to reach infinity. Of course, what's lacking, if you have in mind a possible refinement of this discussion, which is not only Poincaré covariant, but more some step towards general covariance, but we would like to have first a better condition to avoid the formation of closed trapped surfaces. We use a very naive condition, the G00 should not become negative. neglecting the other components of the GPU. And second, we should try to impose this uncertainty relation on gauge invariant quantities out of the coordinates. But these are steps much further ahead. And the result of this discussion, in a way, looked quite acceptable. It's the uncertainty relation which were on the blackboard before, which you can find in this paper 94-95. Okay, so this I skipped for the moment the discussion of the first half and upper half. This is what you, the scenario you would have if you push this argument to the very end, having the Q mu depending upon G. This re-equation or something alike would be coupled equation of motions. Let's go to the basic model. As I told you, it's just summarized by the simple conditions that the commutator between the coordinate is a anti-symmetric to tensor, whose contraction itself is zero, and whose contraction with its Hodge dual has square, which is essentially one. Yeah? So this is the real quantum condition. Yeah? Actually, this is just a symmetry condition. It means that the uncertainty relation between space and time on one side and between space and space on the other bring in the same constant, yeah? The Planck constant. That's symmetry condition. Well, this is the essential. About the last condition, if you like algebra, I would like just to point out that this invariant, which is under the square here, which is only pseudo-invariant, yeah, is actually the natural measure of the non-commutativity of these four operators, because you can re-express it in this way, like the determinant of a matrix which has all the rows equal to one another, yeah? But the determinant is non-zero because these objects don't commute, and the definition of the determinant is just this one. Yeah? But this you can express very easily in terms of QVU and its Hodge dual. Okay, so this is the basic model. And if you look at this commutator matrix, you can write it in terms of an electromagnetic part. And then you discover that the quantum condition, just that the electric part is as long as the magnetic part. This is the symmetry we're mentioning. This is just the condition that the Q contraction itself is zero. And the other condition, the true quantum condition, that the square of the scalar product is one. Now, if you just inspect this equation and think of the joint eigenvalues of this central operator, yeah, the joint eigenvalues are just numerical anti-symmetric tensors which span a manifold, which is defined by these two equations. And this manifold obviously has two disconnected components, because this could be plus or minus one. And each of these two disconnected components is easily seen to be an orbit under the proper Lorentz group of a single point. Yeah? And as such, it's just a quotient, the proper Lorentz group model stabilizer. If you choose the point at your ease, you find that the stabilizer is just the boost along the z direction combined with rotation around the z direction. And if you write this in SL to C, you discover this is just the quotient of SL to C mod of the diagonal, the subgroup of diagonal matrices. Yeah? Or else, if you think of there is a base in this manifold, this will be very important in the sequel. The base is the points where not only E scalar M is plus or minus one, but also E is parallel or anti-parallel to M. Yeah? This means they have both lengths one. So the base is two copies of the unit sphere, unit in Planckian units, of course, in three-dimensional space. But if you go, want to reach from one point of the sphere, a generic point, it's enough to take a boost, but boosts along the direction of this vector will affect nothing. So it's enough to take a boost in an orthogonal direction. So you just have to give a vector orthogonal to the unit vector, maybe a vector tangent to the unit sphere. So you see that this manifold is just the tangent manifold to the unit sphere. And so the sigma altogether is the tangent manifold to the unit sphere product with a two-point set. Okay, and it's also a nice algebraic variety if you like to see that in this way. Okay, now, what does it mean that you have non-commutative coordinates? Yes?
You said it, but I just, can you repeat why do you assume that Q dot Q is zero?
Capital Q dot...
Capital Q dot capital Q is zero.
Well, these three relations that I wrote are justified by the fact that they implement exactly the minimal uncertainty relations. Yeah? So this is the real reason. But if the fact that you choose the commutator of capital Q with a small q to be zero is just convenience, simplicity, simplest choice. And the other two conditions are those which fit exactly those uncertainty relations. If we took Q contracted with itself not zero, you would have the same consequences, but the two uncertainty relations that I wrote down would have different constants. That's all. Yes? Yeah, but Minkowski space is flat. Minkowski space is flat, and so there's no problem. If that's what you are heading, you are just quantizing Minkowski space with this flat metric.
But you have the commutators, so then the Hodge depends on where you put the G's to define the Hodge.
Yeah, but the G are the normal diagonal matrix plus 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. So obviously it's commutative because the Minkowski space is flat. Okay, now, having non-commuting coordinates means that you have to replace the description of Minkowski space by this commutative algebra of continuous functions which go to zero at infinity by a non-commutative sister algebra. Which one? It is the sister algebra, which is the enveloping sister algebra of the regular representation of the commutation relations. Namely, as in quantum mechanics, you go from Heisenberg to Weyl. Here we go from commutation relation between Qs to commutation relation with these Weyl operators. And here you have, instead of a C number phase, a central phase which appears, but everything is the same. Yeah? And then what does it mean, the enveloping sister algebra? You want a sister algebra whose representation are in one to one correspondence with the representation of these relations. And you just follow the remarkable footprints of von Neumann. You read just his paper on the uniqueness of the representation, the Weyl relation. You do the same thing. So then you have to consider an algebra which is spanned by the linearization of your relations. Yeah? And if you want, you can talk of this algebra in terms of functions on the product of sigma and R4. Yeah? And these functions have to be obey an algebra under a twisted convolution product where the twisting depends upon the point in sigma. Little sigma is the generic point in this manifold sigma or joint eigenvalues of the commutator. Yeah? So the twisting depends upon the point. So you see that a priori also for a fixed non-degenerate, all the sigma, this is important, all the sigma non-degenerate automatically by the quantum conditions. If you just fix one, you know that the algebra, the algebra generated by this twisted convolution algebra is just algebra of compact operators by the von Neumann theorem. Yeah? So you might expect that there is here a field of the algebra of compact operators over sigma, which might be non-trivial, but it is trivial. That's a theorem. Sorry? No, alpha is just a parameter here. Just a generic parameter, which is, I mean, is the conjugate parameters to the Qs, but it's a C number parameter. Yeah? It's four vector. Yeah?
It will have something to do with momenta.
Not really, just formally. Yeah? It's just like describing an operator taking its functions, F or capital A, as the integral F of lambda e to the I lambda t integrated over lambda. Yeah? Just the Fourier transform of the function that you evaluate on the Qs. Okay, so in our first papers in the 90s, we proved that this bundle is trivial. This means that the sister algebra is just a trivial field, which means the tensor product of the continuous function of sigma vanishing at infinity with the compact operators and separable infinite dimensional Hilbert space. And this algebra carries a nice action of the full Poincaré group as automorphism, which acts in the proper way on the coordinates. Of course, the coordinates are unbounded operators which don't lie in the sister algebra, but in a very well precise mathematical sense, they are affiliated to the sister algebra. If you look at the old paper I mentioned, you find the discussion of that, but that would be too long to talk here. Now, this is the algebra which replaces the commutative algebra of function space time. It's a non commutative algebra. And then you, of course, you miss space time as a set of points, becomes a quantum space. Yeah, this is the most general notion of quantum space. According to the philosophy, started with a paper of Gelfand and Neimer in 1943, but pushed through only much later to the extreme possibilities by the work of Alan Cohn. Yeah. Yeah, it's a representation of the Poincaré group as automorphism of the algebra. And you can define that simply on the functions of sigma and alpha, which were on the screen before. Yeah, yeah, the algebra is non-commutative, but the action is the proper action of the classical group, which acts in a perfectly nice way. Okay, so this is the algebra which describes quantum space-time, but what happens to points? Well, the general philosophy is that when you take a non-commutative algebra, or a better non-commutative sister algebra, to describe a non-commutative space, the non-commutative space is sort of described in a fuzzy way by states over the algebra, which means expectation functionals, which are positive, linear, normalized, yeah? And they replace points. But one has to be careful. Even in classical, in a classical space, a generic state is just a probability measure. So you don't want any state. And on quantum, in the quantum case, we know from quantum mechanics that even pure states, we don't have a nice classical counterpart. So you must choose well your states. And the best you can do if you want to choose well your states is to consider optimally localized states, namely states where the sum of the square of the uncertainties is minimum. Now, two remarks are in order immediately. First, the minimum is not guaranteed that it exists. It could be an inf, but it will exist. It will be a minimum. This will be a result. Second remark, very important, this notion is no longer Lorentz invariant. So a state which is optimally localized for us is not necessarily optimally localized for our friend which is traveling on a train. Okay, now that we did already in the first paper, we proved that the state is optimally localized. First, the minimum exists, the inf is just a minimum. A state is optimally localized if it only first, it lives only on the base, sigma 1 of sigma. Any state defines a probability measure over sigma. This probability measure has to be concentrated on sigma 1 first, and then it has to take the simple form on elements in your algebra, which is a total set, but not a, I mean, it's generating set for the algebra, not a linearly, not a dense subspace, because here in general we need all the function of the commutator. Yeah? On simple elements of this form, it gives just this simple expectation with the integration with these Gaussian functions. Yeah? And, okay, this is a complete characterization of the optimally localized states. And what does it mean, the fact that the base is taken in? Well, the base is the full orbit of a single point under the improper rotation group, that under Lorentz. So choose just your preferred point. For instance, E equal to M, yeah, and equal to the first vector in our frame, yeah, to the vector number 1 in our frame. The corresponding irreducible representations, then, the corresponding regular representation are very simple. Adjust the Q's and P's operators of Schrödinger for a particle in 2 degrees of freedom. Yeah? Just because your sigma becomes the standard symplectic form. Yeah? And so you can describe them as a multiplication by S and minus E d over ds on L2. Of R, but here you have L2, tensor L2, because you have two copies. Yeah? There is something mysterious here, too, why quantum space-time leads us in some way to a two-dimensional underlying space. You see, this two-dimensional underlying space, which enters in so many domains of physics, enters here, too, by a completely different way. That's mysterious. Anyway, if you take this representation, you write the sum of the square of the coordinates, it's just a combination of the harmonic oscillator in the first, it's just a harmonic oscillator in the two variables. Yeah? And then we know the spectrum of this. Of course, this sum of square will be larger than 2. But this is a theory that holds for any optimally localized states, not only for the special ones. Okay, and one more thing I will need in a moment is that any optimally localized state can be obtained in a sort of universal way by a map row, which is just the restriction of your function from sigma to the compacts to the base, followed by a conditional expectation of this algebra, which maps onto the center, which is actually the center of the multiplier algebra, but that's just a mathematical subtlety, combined with something which is the only choice you have, a probability measure on the base. But this universal map here will play an important role in a moment. Okay. And the universal map is just written for you here, explicitly just for your memory. Okay, so maybe I can just flash this as I'm going a bit too slow. The classical limit, namely when you can neglect the Planck length of this space, is easily seen to be C0 over 4 cross sigma, because the convolution becomes, the twisting of the convolution becomes negligible, so you find the limit ordinary convolution, which means that it is a Fourier transform of pointwise product. Yeah? And then you find this. This means the quantum space M does not go back to R4 at large distances, but it goes back to R4 times sigma. What does this mean? Well, this is when you take any state to probe your events. But if you take optimally localized states, you don't find all of sigma, as I told you. We find only sigma 1, which is the unit sphere, unit in Planck units, of course, times a discrete point with a space with only 2 points. Now, this is very interesting for several reasons. On the one side, you see here a new phenomenon. Quantum spacetime foresees, predicts extra dimensions. And extra dimensions are now very simple. They are compactified by the fact that you look at optimally localized states. And the other thing is the discrete space with the 2 components appear here, which was the essential key for the explanation of the standard model by Kohn and Lott in the early 90s. And this is also intriguing. And the other thing you can say, even if you don't take the classical limit, but you just look at optimally localized states, I told you that the coordinates become just a pair of Schrödinger operators. Yeah? Then the quantum spacetime is just the phase space for a 2-dimensional particle, for a particle in 2 dimensions. Yeah? And then we know by quantum mechanics the phase space is discretized into cells in 3 spacetime to be volume h cube. Yeah? In 2-dimensional space, if the constant is lambda square, as it does, the volume is lambda to the fourth. So the quantum spacetime predicts an effective subdivision of the continuous. The quantum continuous behaves like a discrete of cells of volume lambda Planck to the fourth. Yeah? So this is a nice way of introducing discretization without discretizing the space, but by non-commutativity, and not in the context of gravity, but in a more general context, it was already anticipated by John Mador. 92. Yeah. Yes, there was a question.
I don't understand the statement that this is a kind of Kaluza-Klein space time.
This is a
kind of Kaluza-Klein space time.
Not really.
We talked about extra dimensions.
Yeah.
But it seems that sphere, that's a geometrical sphere in ordinary space. So
yeah.
More like just attaching a vector to every point of space time. It's not like. It's not like having a
5th
dimension or a 6th dimension, which is internal.
Yeah, that's a good point. But if you allow me, I would come back to this point later, because I think one of the main problems that we meet in the definition of interacting quantum field theory is that we were unable to give a dynamical meaning to this manifold sigma. I think this manifold sigma should have a dynamical meaning. And it's also like a spectator that we want to remove by integration. One of the roots of the breakdown of the Lorentz invariance, they cannot integrate because it's an infinite manifold, so the invariant measure gives you infinite. And you cannot average on it because the Lorentz group does not admit any average because it's what mathematicians call non-amenable group. So I'll come back to this point if you don't mind a bit later. So on this space, quantum spacetime, you have a calculus. You can compute functions of the non-commutative operator by von Neumann prescription. You can, and then the product becomes just the twisted convolution described. You can have a differential calculus, which is described as the differential of the space time translations. You have integration, which is given by the trace. And you have even the integration at fixed time, which makes sense because it's not in conflict with the uncertainty relation. And mathematically, it is given as a as the appropriate limit of the integration of the whole space when you concentrate on a slice. Now, all this is pretty well known. It was started in this work in 1995. I would like to spend a few words on independent events. As in quantum mechanics, we have to describe independent events by tensor product copies. Yeah? But here you have a choice, which tensor product to take. We want the commutator, this is the only sensible choice, the commutator between two components of the same coordinate does not depend on the place where you have put your coordinates. This means that you have to take tensor product not over C, but over the center of the multiplier algebra, which is just a continuous bounded functions over sigma, which multiply your algebra. This, what does it mean, tensor product over Z? It's high words, but it means something very simple. It means if you take an A and the B in your algebra, and you multiply by one of these central multipliers, multiplying the first or multiplying the second tensor product has the same result, right? But this can be rephrased in a nice compact way, saying that in some sense, that given by the universal differential calculus, the differential of the commutator is zero. We'll come back to this later, hopefully, if I have time, the last part of this talk. Okay, now, if you use this tensor product where the commutator is the same at each place, you have an important consequence, that the normalized barycenter, namely when you divide not by n the sum, but by square root of n, obeys among its components exactly the same commutation relations as the Q themselves. And the difference variables, if you normalize them by square root of 2, also obey the same commutation relations as the Q themselves. And which what will be more very important in the sequel, the commutator, the bicenter coordinates with the differences is zero. Yeah. I don't know why I put a rho here. This should be lambda, of course. Yeah. Okay. And the second statement here has an interesting consequence. Since these variables Q, J, K obey the same algebra, they have also to reproduce the phenomenon that is shown before, that the sum of the squares of all the components is bounded below by something other one. This means that the Euclidean distance between two events is bounded below by something of order one in Planck units. You see, this looks like a very non-covariant statement, but it is a consequence of our Poincaré covariant algebra. This is very important. Actually, let me stress at this point that these three concepts, which seems to be confused very often in the literature, or sometimes, maybe at least sometimes. One is the possible covariance of quantum space-time. Another one is the fact that you have a quantum space-time, but each coordinate can be measured with arbitrary precision. This is no contradiction in quantum space-time, and this is still certainly possible. And the third is that there is a minimal length in this sense, which again is no contradiction with relativistic invariance, as this model shows. Okay, now, the fact that you cannot put this difference Qj minus k equal to zero without violating the algebra, of course you can, but that would be no longer achieved by positive states. It would be violation of your algebraic relation. You can take this into account in defining the big product. If you think of what big products are classically, you just define products of, say, free fields at different points. You subtract what Vic told us we should subtract, yeah, not to have divergences. And then the limit where all the points coalesce exists and gives you a nice field, which is the big power. Now, quantum space-time, you cannot put Qj minus Qj equal to zero. Yeah? So what can you do? The best you can do is to apply what we call the quantum diagonal map, which is a map of your n-fold tensor product algebra, which sets the difference variables as small as they can be and leaves the barycenter invariant. In brief, you can do that mathematically in this way, in two steps. The first step is to exploit the fact that the barycenter commutes with the Qj minus Qk, and then map this into a first Qmu in an n plus one tensor product, and the difference is to the differences of the remaining variables after the first one. So you set these two into tensorial disjoint components as tensors over Z, of course. And why can you do that? Because the fibers are compact operators. Saying the two copies of the compact operators commute is the same as saying that they live in a tensor product, different components of the tensor product. So this is mathematically well justified and defines actually a star monomorphism of the full tensor product into the n plus one tensor product. Once you have done that, you realize easily that setting the difference as small as it can be is the same as evaluating eta on all the factors in this product. So you just compose the map side that I just decided, that I just introduced, with the map which is the identity in the first factor, so the bicentered variable remains alone, and tensor eta, this universal localization map, which selects for you the optimally localized states if you compose with the probability measure of the center, yeah, on all the other factors. And the result is a map En that you call the quantum, we call the quantum diagonal map, which maps functions of the n independent events into function of a single variable, which is the bicentered variable normalized this way. Yeah. This is, of course, rotation invariant, but no longer Lorentz invariant, because the map eta, as I told you earlier, depends upon the frame. Okay, now this map, please try to keep that in mind because it will be very important in a few moments. Eh? This will be very important. Now let's go to quantum field theory. Oh, my God. Okay, we just evaluate fields on quantum space-time as we did long ago using this tensor product. And then you want to introduce interactions, just replacing phi of x by phi of q in the interaction Lagrangian. You have several ways of doing that. You can use the Young-Feldman equations, as we did in some papers with Dorothea Bounce, Klaus Friedenhagen, and Gerardo Piacitelli. Yeah. And you can, in the Young-Feldman equation, approach the problem of renormalization defining in various ways the weak product. You could define what we call the quasi-planar weak products by subtracting from here only those terms which are actually divergent on quantum space-time, but not subtracting the ones which are finite, because at the same time the finite terms are non-local. So it is somehow against the spirit of quantum field theory. And we proved that the quasi-planar weak product defined this way does define for you fields which exist on quantum space-time, provides for you a Lorentz covariant scheme of renormalization, but it's only partial renormalization because you did not make the subtractions. If you want to compare with the results in the approximation lambda equals zero, you have to do a further renormalization which will break Lorentz invariance. So there are problems at any level. Another approach that we followed is the S-matrix approach. So you just write as an ansatz the Gell-Mann law formula, and you write down what your interaction, what the interaction is. And the first thing you would like to write is what is here on the screen. But this is still dependent upon the center. Now, what you first tried is can you average over the center? But you cannot average in an invariant way. So the first choice we took was just to integrate over the center, but only on the base of the center, so to break Lorentz invariance at this point. This introduces a mild regularization, which later Dorothea Bounce proved, however, to be sufficient for phi to the three. Sorry, but it's not a full regularization. It's not known. And another thing, which is a bit subtle, you could do, is to introduce, instead of the ordinary big product, the quantum big product, which is defined evaluating this tensor product. This is tensor product as the factor Q go. So you can read this as phi of Q1, phi of Q2, up to phi of Q3, phi of Qn, yeah, to apply to this our quantum diagonal map. And we get in this way what we call the quantum big product. If you do this, the interaction Hamiltonian does no longer depend upon sigma at all. It lives on sigma 1, but it's independent of sigma, which is very nice. And if you use this to define the scattering matrix, a Lagelman law, and you divide by the vacuum-vacuum graphs, which would remain divergent, the rest is ultraviolet finite. Divergence in left, provided you introduce an adiabatic cutoff. But to remove the adiabatic cutoff, I should say immediately, seems to be rather a problem. Also, some progress has been done recently by some young PhD in Hamburg, Kosov and Jochen Zahn. They made some progress in this problem. Yes?
So if you adopt non-commutative quantum field theory, the non-commutative quantum gravity, then you can show them that when you do actually final graphs, the loop graphs, and then magnify to the fourth, the planar graphs are still protracted divergent. The non-planar ones can be made ultraviolet finite given certain conditions. Mm-hmm. And when you do it, gravity expanding around in cosmic space time, the planar graphs, the first one, vacuum polarization of gravity, is quantically divergent.
We didn't do that for gravity, but if you allow me to say just what is maybe the answer, the point is that we think that this is a first step towards developing quantum field theory on a better background, which is suggested by quantum gravity. But I don't think that it is enough to consider gravity on this fixed background. People usually consider quantum gravity on the fixed background, even with a fixed sigma. To me, not only sigma cannot be fixed, because otherwise you lose Lorentz invariant, you have to take the whole orbit, but if you want to use gravity, sigma cannot be even fixed to sigma, capital sigma. It has to become really a quantum variable. So I think it should be, one should go. But if you allow me, I would prefer to postpone such questions, which are very interesting, to which I will be happy to discuss, even if I don't have an answer at the end, otherwise I cannot reach the point. Yes?
Short question. Does the distinction between positive and negative frequencies survive in this time period?
Oh, yes, certainly. You see, the
weak rotation of the weak product is used that in the usual way.
Well, but you face all the problems of the normalization if you use the usual weak product, you have a lot of diagrams which are divergent. So the virtue of this was to do it, if you use the planar weak product, you do it in a Lorentz covariant way, and for fixed lambda, you remove the divergences. If you do it this way, you remove all ultraviolet divergences, but then you are left with a very tough problem, which is not only the adiabatic problem, but also the problem of the limit when lambda goes to zero. So to me, this is not yet the full answer. In order to have something you can compare with experiments, if you really believe in such a thing, we need to apply to this ultraviolet finite power expansion a finite renormalization in such a way that when you take the limit lambda goes to zero, you get the usual renormalized expansion. Otherwise, it would make no sense. You have terms which diverge. But I would prefer to discuss this point later, if you allow me. I would just tell you one thing, that in both cases, either you take the old choice or the new choice, there is a common phenomenon that the interaction Hamiltonian gets replaced by a non-local Hamiltonian, which is just spread off by some non-local kernel, and what changes is the nature of non-local kernel. Yeah? But one word of warning, we made this warning very explicit in our 1995 paper, but it has not been read by many people. Yeah? If the time order refers to the variables t which are inside here, not to the x variable in the fields. If you time order with respect to the x variable here, you get field rules, but you violate unitarity. If you take this other time ordering, you lose Feynman propagator, you have the Denk-Schwede propagator, rather, some more complicated propagator, but you don't spoil unitarity. So the change from one to another is something which is somehow suggested by looking at the Moyal product as something local to this formula, but it is not local. It's local only for analytic functions, where local and global are the same thing. Okay, so if you, this is a picture of what really happens. You see that you have two time order with this, ordered with respect to the baricenter of the bubbles, not with respect to the individual time variable, which appear here. And Gerardo Piacitelli has a very nice paper in JHEP where he gives the modified Feynman rules for this complicated propagator, which are essentially the old ones, but with very complicated propagators. Okay, the next thing I just flash very briefly is why the theory is ultraviolet finite. It is because the famous kernel turns out to be of this form. Apart from the delta function, which reflects transition invariance, it's a Gaussian in all directions. Then you can imagine why you get something finite in the ultraviolet and why all the S-matrix elements will fall off fast at large energy momentum transfers. Okay.
So if you numbers back again in your equation, you will find that your commutational relations or your uncertainty relations depend on some mass, no? So
depend
on a mass on some cutoff.
Well, the uncertainty relation depends only on the Planck length in this model.
Yeah, let's say the Planck length. Okay. So all these numbers, yes, are finite, but will be strongly dependent.
Yeah, that's what I said a few minutes ago. I mean, to compare this with the observation, you need a finite renormalization, which is finite now, but it is there, which allows you to recover the classical limit when lambda Planck goes to zero. If you don't make this renormalization, this would explode. Would be finite, but exploding when lambda Planck goes to zero.
So can you call that a regularization?
Yeah, it requires finite renormalization. I think this is the best way you can put it. Okay, now I would like to pass to the third part of the talk in the remaining 8 minutes. What?
Yeah.
More or less. Okay.
10 minutes.
Thank you. So I have just to say to you a few words for algebra, because I told you that we want to compute the spectrum of the volume operator, for instance. Yeah? But where does this volume operator sit? In which algebra? We need an algebra which is good enough to deal with the differential calculus. And the best thing to do is what's called the universal differential calculus. In the universal differential calculus, the differential of an element of a generic algebra is just given by this expression. This is not really the most general universal, not really universal, because I stipulate here that the algebra has a unit and the differential of the unit is zero, which need not to be the case. Anyway, we took that, take that case. Yeah? And if you want details, you just look at the book of Alain. And this algebra can be accommodated in a tensor algebra where you take all the tensor powers of A and you take the direct sum. Now, it's very important to realize that you have on this tensor algebra not only the obvious algebraic structure, when you can multiply two tensors of order n one another to get another tensor of order n, just taking A1B1, tensor A2B2, etc. This is ordinary product. But you have another product that you obtain considering each of these tensor powers as what's called in mathematics an A by module. That means something you can multiply by elements of A itself, both on the left and on the right by this rule. And then you define the A by module tensor product between such things. Yeah? What does this mean? These terrible words mean something very simple. Mean that you just multiply two tensors, just contracting the last term of the first with the first term of the second, using the product in A. So that the A by module tensor product of two monomials like that is a monomial of the n plus n minus 1 because of this contraction. Yeah? So if you take a power of elements in so what did I write here? Yeah, if all elements are tensor product of pairs, the product in this algebra will not live in a terrible high order factor, but just a tensor n plus 1. Because each time you multiply a pair with the next one, you have two times contractor, you just one add one factor. So in particular, if you consider the differentials and you multiply n differentials, you get an element in A tens of n plus 1. Yeah? In particular, the product of four differentials of quantum space-time will be affiliated, because an unbounded operator is not an element of set algebra, to the fifth tensor power. And this is why this square root of 5 will come out. Okay, now the universal differential algebra is just the subalgebra of this big algebra. So you take lambda of A equipped with this A bimodule tensor product. Yeah? So you can multiply any two tensors and get another tensor. So it becomes an algebra. And the universal differential algebra is just the subalgebra generated by the elements in the algebra itself and the differentials. And you can characterize it easily as a subspace, how it comes up. Okay, now you have two, yes?
Just for orientation, are we supposed to think of this as an algebra of all forms or just all tensors in general?
Well, the omega of A is an algebra of forms. It is generated by A's and the A. The D obeys the usual Leibniz rule. Yeah? So this means that if you, the most general element will be A1, DA2, DAC up to DAM. This is the most general element. The linear combination of this will span the algebra. So it is an omega of A is an algebra of form. Yeah? But it sits in this tensor algebra in a natural way. Okay, now, the important point is lambda of A. Suppose even now that A is a sister algebra. Lambda of A can be completed in an easy way into a sister algebra, just the direct sum of the nth order tensor powers. Yeah? So it has a nice sister algebra structure, but it has also this algebraic structure, which is not at all a sister algebra structure. Yeah? So you have to remember that if you want to calculate doing the differential calculus, then the product has to be taken in lambda way. If you want to say how big is your operator, you have to take norms and spectra in the sister algebra. So these two structures which come in together, which is, are very important. Okay, now I had something on the universal differential operator and its dual here, but we'll jump it because I'm being too slow. Now let's go to the quantum space-time. In this case, we don't take the universal differential calculus, but something a bit more specialized, because the tensor product that we're talking about will be now Z by module tensor product, as above. Namely, the tensor product will obey this relation. If you take a multiplier from the center here, it will be the same as putting it here. And this means just that the differential of center elements is zero. So this is exactly the equation I had on the screen earlier on, that the differential of the commutator is zero. Okay, so you stipulate that. This is just what I said in words. And I remind you that this means that the commutator of the coordinates is the same for all at all places. And it implies that if you take 1 over square root 2 of the differential, then these things obey the same commutation relations as the basic union. Okay, QNU. The basic results now that I announced already are this one on the spectrum of area and volume. And I think I will skip the first one because essentially I explained that to you already. I will, be very brief on the area operator, which is very easy. I will skip the three volume, which is a bit more involved, but not too much. Because the most interesting part, which I would like to have some time for, is the four volume. Yeah. Okay, so first of all, I told you already one has to use the sister algebra structure to evaluate norms and to evaluate the products in the lambda algebra. Okay, now, the area, space area. If you just take the exterior product of dqj, where dqk, this means that you take the dqj is just this difference. You multiply it in lambda with dqk. This means that here the elements which come in contact, which are the last place in the first, when they come in contact with the first things which are in the first place and the second, they multiply in the algebra. Yeah? And then this will live in the threefold tensor product. Yeah? And then you have to anti-symmetrize, of course. Yeah? Then you see immediately you have two kinds of term. This is the basic gymnastic which will take place in all this discussion. You have the terms where the Qs after this product still live in different factors of the tensor product, because what came in contact with the other term was an identity. And the terms where you have one Q here and one Q here, which give you a term like that. And when you anti-symmetrize, the fate of these two things is quite different. Because if you have A tensor B with AB self-adjoint operator, you take minus B tensor A, it's still self-adjoint. But if you take one tensor AB minus one tensor BA, it's not self-adjoint, it's your joint. But in this case, you can find something very simple, because you have only this simple coincidence, which is you just the commutator, which is central, right? So if you look at this thing, it is becomes very easy. The DQJ wedge DQK is a normal operator because the imaginary part was central, so it's square, just the sum of the square, and the sum of the square is of course larger than the square of any two terms, in particular this one. So if you now you sum over the three magnetic components of the square, what you get at the right hand side, you get just this M square, which was, due to the quantum condition, greater or equal than one. So this is the area quantization, the space area quantization. And of course, you have the same for the time space area. Yeah? So this is very, very easy and nice, pleasant, say. Now, I skip the volume, as I said, otherwise Michele will cut me. And I pass directly over to the space-time volume. And I'm afraid I will maybe be a bit over time, but I think this is very interesting. It's amusing, maybe not interesting. It's worth seeing some detail. So if you take now the four-volume operator, of course, now you have a five-fold tensor product with all these self-adjoint operators. When we first sit down and wrote this thing with Klaus Friedenhagen, I think I mentioned this is a joint work with Klaus Friedenhagen, which is still to be written down. It's written up, as my friend Bill Carlson says, but it's not yet. It's written up and not yet written down. Okay, or the other way around. Anyway, when we first looked at this, we said, well, we have all these products of order four in a five-fold tensor product, and with all this anti-symmetrization, it's impossible. We'll never see anything out of this. But we do see something. And you see how it's very, very amusing. So first of all, you have in these terrible things three kinds of terms. Look, classify the products according to the coincidences. There will be terms where no Q comes in contact with another Q because they stick in different factors in terms of products. Yeah? And this will be self-adjoint terms. Okay. Then there will be terms where you have two coincidences. Yeah? Then two pairs come in contact. When one pair comes in contact and you anti-symmetrize, becomes an anti-commutator, which is Q-adjoint. We have two Q-adjoint terms in different terms in terms of product. The product is self-adjoint again and central. So this other term will be self-adjoint and central. But when you have only one coincidence, you will have a Q-adjoint term. Yeah? So the term with two coincidences, as I said, will give you two commutators. If you take into account this epsilon, this is just Q wedge Q, which is one of our invariants, or pseudo-invariants, whose square is one. So you get exactly, apart from the numerical factor, an operator eta, which is central, is plus one of sigma plus and minus one of sigma minus. So it just shuffled in the sign if you take a time inverse or space reflection. Yeah. Okay. Now let's look at the Holter expression. It will be just something of this form. A minus 2 eta, where A is self-adjoint and eta is central, plus an imaginary part beta. Now, you can just take off this. What A is just this combination of the wedge product of the QI, but not all QI. You have to jump one, because you have four Qs in five-fold tensor products, and with this alternating sign. And you call AJ the individual term in this sum, apart from the sign, because this will be important. And B similarly has a form of this type. We have the Q, which comes from the one coincidence, which is the commutator, wedge QI, wedge QJ, again with some sign. And again, we single out this BIJ, which is just defined by this formula. And then you have to compute some commutator. And something amusing happens. If you take the commutator BIJ with the component of the Q someplace, you find out that here enters the matrix product of the Q matrix with its Hodge dual. But this matrix product is a property anti-symmetric matrix. It's just a multiple identity where the multiple is just the contraction, which was again this operator eta. So this relation simplified to this form, where apart from the presence of this central operator, central sign, this is something very familiar. It's just the action on the Qs of a generator of the orthogonal group in five dimensions. And this is the hint. Everything will step by step fall down into the realm of compact groups. And that will be the reason why the spectrum will be pure point. Yeah. Okay, now, if you compute how this BJ acts, as I said, and then you consider the B itself, you realize by a simple formula that at B leaves this expression invariant. So at B acts as a generator of some one parameter subgroup in the stabilizer of the vector 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 5 times in SO5. Now A itself, which was given by this formula, it can be written in this form, yeah, as a full, as a big determinant of a 5x5 matrix. Yeah. Now, in this big determinant, of course, if you insert here, I think it's useless to cover, since your attention distracted anyway. if you insert a factor here, which is another matrix with determinant 1, of course, the determinant and product is not changed. But if you take as a matrix R something which is in this group N, which leaves this vector invariant, it will leave this column invariant. Yeah? This means that you will have that this thing is of this form. Yeah? This means that in particular, if you take an infinitesimal transformation in this group, yeah, it will have to leave A invariant. This means that add D has to leave A invariant, and this means that our B, which was the generator, acted as the generator of such a one parameter subgroup, has to commute with A. So this is one of the results I claimed. A and B commute for this simple group theoretic revision. This means that our operator, which was A minus 2 eta, which was central, plus IB, is a normal operator. The real imaginary part commutes, so it commutes its own adjoint. It's not quasi, I'm nearly there. So it's a normal operator, sorry. And then if you want to, thank you. If you want to evaluate the modulus square, just the sum of the squares. So to know that the spectrum keeps away from zero, it will be enough to know that the spectrum of the square of the real part keeps away from zero. Yeah. Now, next big simplification. Our full operator was a Lorentz pseudoscalar. So if you want to know your operator, it's not necessary to work, take into account the whole center. It's just enough to go at one point of the center and to remember that the most that it can happen is that you have to change the sign if you go to the opposite sheet of sigma. Yeah? So just take one point in the center and compute it there. And for convenience, it's enough to take this point where E equals M equals 1, 1, 1. And then you can, you remember, each Q in this case becomes a pair of Schrödinger operators. Now we have five pairs of Schrödinger operators. Yeah? So the situation is described by this slide. Each Q, each, I mean, field bind of Q is of this form. Yeah? And when you want to compute A in terms of these things, you get up with the determinant of this 5x5 matrix. And if you develop that first by the first line and then by the 2x2 minors in this column, you see that the determinant of this minus will be only qi pj minus pj qi. So they will be generators of the rotation group of SO5. And the same for the complementary minors. So this means that the whole thing will be expressed in terms of generators of SO5, in terms of representation of compact group. This already tells you that this object will have a necessarily pure point spectrum because of the theory of compact groups. But now you can even compute this spectrum. The generator of SO5 obey these well-known relations, of course. And now the trick is to take a rotation which sends the column vector, which was 1, 1, 1, to one vector of your base. Now I should go to the next slide to show what happens here. And now we are approaching to the conclusion very fast. You see that if you take such a rotation, then, of course, the determinant does not change if you set this rotation. Then you go to some transform coordinates. But your determinant in the first column has now one of the vectors of the base that you choose. However, there is a normalization factor because a vector with 5 ones has not norm 1, has norm square root of 5. And this is what saves us because we have this square root of 5. 5 because it's dimension space time plus 1. And then you have just to compute this 4x4 matrix. And here you have, again, as before, the generators of SO4 rather than SO5 entering the game. Now, if you express this gadget in terms of the generators of SO4, which appear here, now SO4 is very familiar since when I was rather young, the old days of particle physics before the standard model, before the Eightfold Way, people were working a lot with SO4. And every physicist would know at that age that SO4 contains two independent copies of SU2. And many physicists still know. So if you express these generators in terms of the generators, these two generators SU2, you can express them this way, then you plug down here, you end up with this simple expression. And now it's clear that you can compute the spectrum of this gadget. And you see also what may happen at most is that here you have a false fractions of integers coming in. So this it's clear now that what will happen is that the spectrum, okay, I will just cut it short, the spectrum of this thing will stay away from zero, at least square root of 5 minus 2. But if you do the full computation, you find the answer which was announced much earlier on. And I will just show it to you and then stop for the full spectrum, provided I'm able to dig it out again. So this will be the full spectrum. You can easily show that not only these points, the spectrum has to lie in here, but any point in here is in the spectrum. And there's a nice fact, which is a consequence actually of the elementary algebra on solution algebraic equations, is that this spectrum is stable under multiplication. You can multiply things and you get again elements of the same form. So this means that if you take volumes not only in space-time, but also in higher dimension, in terms of products, of, sets of more and more points in volume, it will always reproduce itself. It has a lot of other funny algebraic properties. Anyway, but I think I went much over my time and I should stop here.
We have 5 minutes So these nice properties of the geometric operators, you said the, you developed everything on a bagel, on flat.
On?
On flat bagel.
Flat, absolutely.
But would you expect similar properties to maybe be maintained if one considered the, a curved space-time, or there's no real argument to expect that to still be there?
I don't think there is any real argument, and I should say I have no feeling. I think the situation becomes really too difficult. I would like to think that everything is kept, but you know, this is similar to one of the things they had on the screen at the beginning. I said this is also related to dark matter, maybe. One would like to think that quantum space-time is such also on a Schwarzschild background, with the additional condition, which is dictated by the same argument, the Schwarzschild radius has to be at least Planck length. But we don't really know that. This would be an extremely interesting result, because it would show that if you believe in quantum space-time, you would predict that black holes under Hawking evaporation must stop at the minimal size. Yeah? And then you could start to dream, how would this contribute to dark matter? Do we live in a immersed in a gas of minimal black holes, which being minimal don't interact any longer? Who knows? That would be very interesting. But I think in order to give a sensible answer to this thing, at least in the framework of quantum space-time, we should really redo this discussion of uncertainties on a curved background, and show that the quantum condition implies that the Schwarzschild radius has to be larger than this minimum, which we do not know.
I guess I don't understand exactly, from a geometrical point of view, why you call this a volume.
Mm-hmm.
If I just look at the notation, think of these are DQs, this would be a volume form. To get a finite volume, you'd have to integrate this over some.
On the on
that would correspond more to what we mean by a finite volume. So what's the relation?
They are the same.
Between this,
it's exactly the same, because you see the Q is Q1 minus Q2 or Q2 minus Q1. So you can interpret the dQ is just the difference in the universal calculus when we are working. dQ is just the difference between two dependent points. So this is just the volume spanned by the different vectors between quantum events. It's exactly the same. I know that the notation could be misleading. This is the point that the reason is just dq is a different, a finite difference in the universal calculus.
So you could have just as well called it delta q or something.
Yeah, but this is the standard name in the universal calculus, I mean, because every differential calculus is a representation of this universal calculus. That's why it's called dQ.
And in the classical case, what are these? Are they differences or are they?
Oh yeah, this would be computing with the differential calculus on a function space would mean that you take as a df, f is a function of one variable, df is a function of two variables, which is f of y minus f of x. This is the universal differential calculus for
so
functions.
It doesn't coincide with what we normally call differential.
No, what you normally call the differential calculus is, as a differential algebra, a representation of this abstract algebra. So whatever you prove for this abstract algebra will be true for any other representation, except the spectrum, of course, which might decrease. But okay, the algebraic relations will be the same. Yes, I mentioned that at the beginning. If you exactly, because if you take a difference between two events, and then you want to compute a Lenz operator taking the square set, the difference is the difference of two self-adjoint operators. But if you compute area, three volume, four volume, you have to take products, and the result you cannot expect to be self-adjoint, because if you permute two vertices, you get a similar expression, but it differs by a commutator. Yeah? So this commutator is Q adjoint term, which has to enter somewhere. Yeah? So this makes it very natural that it is always a non-self-adjoint. What is, there is no a priori reason that I can see why they should be all normal operators. That's a fact. They're all normal operators.
So, thank you. Let's take this figure again.